Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is Sid DeFore from Black Lion Audio. But first, let's talk about YouTube Red. So what is YouTube Red? It's a brand new subscription service that was just launched. And the whole idea is, if you'd like to get rid of those nasty commercials that are playing in front of your videos, this is the way to do it, but it'll cost you $9.99 a month. So there's a couple other things that you get along with YouTube Red. So you get rid of the commercials, that's a given. But the second thing is, you can also play your videos offline. So in other words, you could cache the videos that you want to listen to or watch, and that will happen right on the YouTube app. You can be offline and still listen. The other thing that you can do is you can listen in the background. So for instance, on your phone or your iPad, you can have your music playing in the background while you're working on something else. And then finally, there's also Google Play. Google Play is Google's streaming music service, and you get that for free as part of the YouTube Red service. And likewise, if you're already a Google Play subscriber, you get YouTube Red for free as well. So that's quite a lot of videos and music that you also get as part of the YouTube Red subscription. And there's one final thing that you get, and that's a whole bunch of new programming that YouTube is coming out with, and it's all exclusive, and it's basically their top 10 creators that now get their own shows. Whether you want to see that or not, I don't know. It's actually aimed at another demographic, because it's PewDiePie and a bunch of artists like that. I'm not going to call them artists, a bunch of celebrities. That's actually aimed at a different audience, and it's interesting because the audience that that's aimed at probably won't pay the $9.99 a month. So it's a very interesting thing that they're doing here. There's a lot of backlash, though. And the backlash comes from creators, first of all, because they were forced into signing an agreement saying that they would be part of this. And they were basically told that if they didn't sign the agreement by a certain day, their videos would be hidden, even on the free tier of YouTube. So that forced 98% of the content creators to actually cave. The only people that didn't cave were Disney and the Disney subsidiaries like ESPN, who basically took their videos down. And a few indie labels that rebelled and said, no, we're not going to go for that. One of the other things that's involved in this is the fact that the pay rate is still the same. It's still 55-45. So in other words, if you're a creator, you get 55% of the income from the subscriptions. That's not that good, because just about everybody else in the industry, and that's Spotify, Pandora, you name it, everybody else, is 70% plus. So this isn't a good split, and there's a lot of mumbling and grumbling. But that's going on for quite a while. The other thing is how that actually gets divided amongst the 98% that have signed up for this is still to be determined. So there's a lot of pushback and unhappiness about YouTube Red. So we'll see what happens. I actually think it's a good thing for content creators, because it's another income stream. How much is it going to be, though? Well, that's debatable. And how many people are actually going to sign on? Once again, debatable. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks with a Small Studio. And you can go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. The next thing I want to talk about is John Bonham's sound. I've had several people ask me about that and about how it was mic'd and how did I think he got that sound. And I think I know only because I've spoken to most of the people involved with it, to Andy Johns, for instance, and Eddie Kramer. The big song that everybody always wants the sound of is When the Levee Breaks. And Andy Johns told me, and this is actually documented in my book, The Recording Engineer's Handbook, that it was two mics only. He got two Beyer M160 ribbon mics. Basically, they're in a big house, in the foyer of a big house. So Bonham was on the first floor, and what Andy did is he just hung two of these M160s over the banister of the second floor and captured them that way. Two mics. That was it. In a lot of the other cases, it's two mics as well. It's a mic in front of the kick drum, and it's one mic just above Bonham's head, over the middle of the kit. And that was kind of standard procedure for miking the drums way back then. Glyn Johns, which is Andy's older brother, actually came up with another method, which was the first documented use of stereo drums. and he took a third microphone, which was located just above the floor tom, looking in at the snare drum. And this was placed sort of by accident. The way I was told was this microphone happened to be on Jimmy Page's guitar amp at the time. And they had to change something on the amp, and the second engineer, the assistant engineer, went out and he moved the mic away so we can get closer to the guitar amp so we can change the controls. And he placed it, it just happened to fall that way, above the floor tom. And when he went back in and Bonham started to play, the whole room went crazy because all of a sudden they heard something they hadn't before, and here it was stereo drums. So it's three basic microphones. What kind of mics? Well, they're using big, large diaphragm microphones, mostly U67s and a U47, I understand, that was on the kick. The kick was 6 inches away, and in some cases it might have been 6 feet away. So it really depended on the song. But it was three basic microphones. Whether he would be recording like that today, if he were still alive, is yet to be determined. We don't know. Now, that being said, there's a couple of other things that you should understand about the Bonham sound. The first is Bonham himself. He was a really hard hitter. And when it comes down to it, the one thing we know about studio drum sound is the harder you hit the drums, the better they sound. And it's really the case. And you can have a pretty crappy set of drums and make them sound pretty good if you have a fairly hard hitter. It's just the way it works. So that's one of the things. And Bonham's technique was outstanding. So between a heavy hitter and outstanding technique, wow, that's most of it right there. The other thing is Bonham had big drums. His toms were big. They were 14, 16, and 18 inches, and his kick was a 26 inch by 14 inches deep. That's huge. So there's a big part of it right there. Another part is the tuning. Most people think because it sounded so big that he tuned everything low, but in fact, it was kind of the opposite. The lower heads, the bottom heads and all the drums were actually tuned very tight, and that was a big part of his sound. And both heads on his kick drum, he used a kick drum with the front head. Both heads were tuned very tight on the kick drum. So that was a big part of his sound. The reason being that as you move back from the drums, they actually sound lower. As you get close, you can hear the ping of the drum and you hear the resonance. But as you get back, they seem to sound lower. So if you have distant microphones, which in all cases of his recording, that's the way they were far away, that's a big part as well. Finally, Bonham played behind the beat. He was excellent at this. And this was a really, really big part of the sound. So when you add up the technique that he had, in fact, he was a heavy hitter and he played behind the beat so well. He had big drums. He had a different tuning than most people. And the microphones were, there were very few of them and they were distant from the drums. There's a lot of space. That's the Bonham drum sound. I tried the Glyn Johns method on the last two or three tracking sessions that I did, and it was great. And that was my basic sound, just the three mics. I added tom mics and a snare mic just for a little bit of fill, but my basic sound came from those three mics, and it was wonderful. So I highly recommend it. If you want to try that sound, I think you'll really like it. You could find out more about this in, I guess the Recording Engineer's Handbook has a lot of detail on this. So if you go look at that, you can find, and I think I've written about it in my blog too, if you do a search there, so you can find out a lot more about it and see a lot of diagrams on the microphone setup. My guest today is Sid DeFore from Black Lion Audio. BLA started out by doing much heralded mods on Digi 002s and other similarly priced products, but eventually they began to develop their own designs. Today, BLA has a wide range of very highly thought of products, from mic preamps to converters to one of the best clocks on the market. I spoke with Sid from his office in Chicago. So, what's the Black Lion story?
Well, basically, you want from the get go, the start. The company started with our old owner, where he was just beginning to just mod, different interfaces. He knew some electronic stuff and started modifying some stuff for a couple friends and had a roommate who was a tinkerer as well. And started doing, you know, more and more, and word got around, and he started doing more and more, and decided to start a business doing it. And his so it started off just he and his roommate, and it just basically just grew. Never advertised, and it just things spread by word of mouth, and started hiring, you know, a couple other guys, and it just grew by there. And then I would say what around 2008 is when we. I've been with the company since 2008, and we I think that's when around when we started making our first product. We just from the things that his roommate was is a electronics genius, and he's the one who really came up with a lot of the progression, I would say, from, you know, just starting off just, you know, swapping out different components for better components and things like that, but really came up with the designs and things like that for the conversion, and then also modding the clock that was in some of these interfaces. And what we got really well known for, obviously, is the Digi 002s and 003s. I would say that's kind of where it started. And when we, you know, where we started making our own products, basically we were modding these a lot of the things inside these units, and went, geez, you know, we're completely redesigning the clock while we make our own. And so that's where it started, with the original Sparrow A to D converter and with our microclock. And from there, we one of the other guys that wound up just landing in our lap as one of our interns another genius. He actually, most of the guys, in fact, every guy that came here, except for myself, started as an intern. But that I'm not a technician, so I'm one of the business guys that, you know, pays bills and orders parts and just kind of handles things. And this guy was an intern, was working at Home Depot, but was an absolute genius when it came to designing gear. And he became our main engineer, and he's been the guy behind pretty much everything that we've put out.
Wow. That's interesting. Who would have thought?
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, we really keep it, none of us here have ever had any kind of business mind, which is, I think, really bad in a lot of ways, but really good in a lot of others. So, you know, when we first started doing products, you know, the entire vision of the business since day one has just been to, you know, make really decent gear and, you know, really good sounding stuff. But all of our clientele was basically just small guys, project engineers, or guys from really small studios that don't have any kind of capital to afford, you know, the expense of really good gear. So, you know, we always really endeavored to keep our prices just within their reach. You know, when we would come up with a new product, we didn't do any kind of product, you know, industry research and say, okay, what are other comparable pieces of gear and what are their prices? We would just say, okay, how much do we need to make to be able to make more and, you know, not go under?
Yeah.
And which probably isn't the smartest thing, but that's what we did for years. And in a sense, still sort of do. So we've always really tried to do our best to keep our price, and it's not all about undercutting everybody. It's really just to, you know, to make things accessible. And
are the products made in the U.S.?
Yeah, we make everything right here in Chicago.
Wow.
You know, there's some things we outsource. I mean, certain, you know, there's like some printed circuit boards, you know, will get done. Obviously, it's, you know, but everything else. In fact, there's quite a bit of other service mount stuff on those PCBs that we do right here in house.
That's very cool. It's very American too.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny because I'm I feel like I can have a certain sense of pride in it, and it's kind of bragging rights, because I have nothing to do with what these guys are doing. I'm a fan of it myself, you know. I'm a customer of it myself, you know. So it's definitely unique. It was one of those things where the time was right when things started off, and, you know, we sort of got a foothold and just survived. And when the company started, you know, for the first few years, it was just sort of, you know, the mentality was, well, we'll do this as long as we can. And who knew?
Yeah.
So well, we're still here and we're still, you know, putting out, and it's, you know, I'm pretty amazed that the stuff that we're putting out is very cutting edge and is, you know, arguably some of the best, some of the best gear that's out there. We've got some, you know, we've gone from, you know, Jimmy Smith in his mom's basement, you know, wanting to mod his, you know, his 002 just to, you know, get a little bit better because he can't afford anything else, to, you know, Tony Maserati choosing our converters over, gosh, you know, he could, you know, he could have his pick of whatever he wants, and he's likes our stuff better than anything else.
So yeah, that's impressive, definitely.
Extremely flattering, yeah.
how do you choose the, you know, which products to do, which products to make? Because I'm sure that, like, there's probably a list of things that you'd like to do or you get requests for. So how does that happen?
Well, I'd say at the towards the beginning, it basically was up to our head engineer when he would just sort of get a wild hair and say, you know, I really want a compressor. So he would just start designing one, that kind of thing, or the EQ. That's how those kind of came about. The PM8 was actually started off as a mod to the SM Pro PM8, and I can't remember. I think someone approached us asking for that, so we delved into it, and our guy basically, once he came up with the mod, it was basically the only thing that was the same was the power supply and the chassis, and that's when we decided, you know, it's really kind of not cost effective for one. It winds up being very expensive for the customer, and it would be, you know, it'd be cheaper for us and for the customer if we just did it ourselves. Mm. And yeah, that's where when we came out with that product, you know. But now we are finally trying to get a little smarter about you know, looking at the industry and listening to what people want. We've begun working on our own interface, so that's in the design aspect right now. But that's one of those things that we've been wanting to do, and people have just been screaming for years. We've just never had the resources to do it. You know, we're still an extremely small company. We've 9 guys that work here. And the current ownership, the original owner, he sold a couple of years ago in 2013. And the new ownership, when they came on board, it was a little scary because, you know, they could have just come in and said, what, you're doing all this stuff in-house? This is expensive. Okay, let's farm everything out to China, have it made there, bring it here, assemble it, and sell it. And so we were a little skeptical, a little worried, but when they came on board, they sat us all down and said, look, you guys have pretty much been running this company, and we want to continue doing that. We see what you're doing as you're doing it right, and we don't want to get in the way of that. So they gave us the opportunity and said, this is the point. If you want to change gears, raise prices, you know, if you want to start pricing things for, you know, more competitively, that's fine. We, you know, we'd be actually very for that. Obviously, it would mean more profit. But they said, look, you know, we don't want to change the company. So you do what you want to do. And we all decided, no, we're going to stick to our guns, still do things the same way we've always done, you know, which means lower profit margins. But, you know, we want to stay true to our original customer base. And
yeah, that's cool. Yeah. And the fact of the matter is, there's so many more of those customers out there than there are, you know, on the high end. So it actually makes sense in a lot of ways. And I got to say, you know, even myself, I can afford, you know, the best of everything, really. And I look at pieces of equipment and I go, oh, wait a second. If this is half the price or 3/4 of the price and does just as well as, you know, whatever the high expensive brand is, why spend the extra money, you know?
Really? Yeah. You know, and that's one of those, I mean, when you face it, there's a lot of these larger manufacturers, they sort of don't have a choice because they're larger company, much, much larger companies. There's so much more overhead. And, you know, we don't have that. Like I said, you know, we're 9 guys working in a great big room. We used to be in this loft space. We just moved to the building next door in May. So we're still in a great big room, and yeah, we don't have that kind of overhead. So we're able to, and we're able to do what we want. And I think it's a really cool thing that that we have that freedom.
Yeah, no kidding.
That kind of thing.
That's pretty awesome.
You know, so yeah, so we're yeah, we're still just plugging away. We got a couple of new things coming out. Couple preamps that 500 series that we've been, you know, looking to do for a while. And that's one of the things of being a small company like us, though, with that lower profit margin, you know, we're making less money on the stuff we sell. It takes us, yeah, you know, four or five times as long to save up the capital to be able to, you know, release new products and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
We have a coffee budget. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So yeah, we have to count pennies and things, but pretty happy with how it is.
I think your customers can appreciate that though, because they're in the same boat in many ways. So that, you know, that's pretty cool. You know, you can relate better.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's part of kind of who we are. What we are our customers. You know, we're the exact same. All of us, you know, none of us can afford to go out and buy. I was talking to a guy this morning. You know, a customer had called up asking about our MicroClock Mark III, which is the new version of the clock we just released, and was asking how it compares with the Antelope. And he said, you know, well, before you released this, did you run these tests? And we're going, and I was telling him, like, we don't have the money to go buy an Antelope clock just to run tests on it. I've never heard an Antelope clock. My God, I can't afford that. So we just did the best we could and wound up getting in the hands of a couple customers who did have them for them to do the shootouts.
Mm.
And, you know, because the proof's always in the pudding, you know, so it's if our customers are happy with it, and if they, you know, we were hoping that it would just even be close or comparable. We had no idea that it would test out as well as it did.
Mm, yeah. Is that your best?
Blown away with how good it was as well.
Is that your best-selling product?
The clock right now, pretty close. I think it's kind of that, and a couple of our pre's. The B173 preamp is still flying pretty well, because that's another one that we a lot of folks, you know, we always get you know, requested to do clones, and we've never. We're not that kind of company. We don't want to do that. You know, what's been done has been done, and we respect that. So what we've done, whenever we've you know, come out with different things, we've, like with the B173, it definitely has a new 1073 sound to it, but it's absolutely not a clone. You know, same with the B12. It's, you know, like a 312-ish type of preamp. But definitely not a clone. Has definitely our own spin to it, and yeah, that's sort of kind of how we did. So the B173 is going pretty well. A lot of people like it. I personally really like it.
I actually respect that, because hey, you know, the original of, you know, whatever it is has already been done, and you know, try to do it differently or better. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of manufacturers that are doing that, and you know, again, it sets you apart from everybody else, because you can go, well, I can get this, the real thing, or I can get this, which may be better for less, so or both, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you can do it, sure, why not?
Yeah.
The engineer that I work with, I'm actually the only person here who is not an engineer. Everybody else that works here, they're all different mixing and tracking engineers, and you know, outside of work, I'm only a musician, and you know, I've produced a couple albums and, you know, different projects and things like that, but I definitely don't have the ear that, you know, of some of these other guys, which is kind of funny, because I've been in a punk band for about 15 years, so I'm the lowest common denominator when it comes to listening to shootouts. They get me in here and they say, you know, let's get Sid to listen to this stuff, because if I can hear it, anybody can, you know. So that's I'm usually the first guinea pig to listen to different AB comparisons and shootouts that we're doing, but we every one of us here are. You know, we're equal with our customers. You know, no one here has a big, personally has any kind of big budget. So, You know, that's why we really try to approach things the way we would with our peers, you know, our friends, different other guys that we know in the industry and stuff like that. You know, that's who we, it's sort of who, I know it sounds corny, like it's a you know, some salesy thing, but it's really kind of who we are. We're not the best businessmen by any means. You know, basically the guys that are running the company are guys that just know the gear and know and have the talent of designing this stuff and putting it together. And we sort of just kind of had to, you know, learn the ropes the hard way.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
We're getting it.
Do you guys still do mods?
We sure do. Yeah.
Yeah. How do you reconcile that? Because it seems that, that would take away, you know, some of the resources from your manufacturing.
Oh yeah, it definitely does. Well, we have a couple guys that basically stick with doing mods. One of those guys has actually been stepping up a little bit and doing some designing of his own. In fact, he a couple of the 500 series pre's that were one that we are releasing now and another one that's going to be coming hopefully before the end of the year. He's had a big hand in that, but that's part. It's part of the bread and butter of the business because there's still such a high demand for it. You know, we've talked about, you know, maybe is this something we should move away from, but there's still so many guys that, you know, are able to benefit from, you know, holding on to the interface that they have, and by putting in less money than it would take to upgrade to a better interface, and we're able to modify their interface so it performs better than what they would upgrade to.
With,
you know, so when it comes to our mods, we basically we're very selective when it comes to what we decide that we're going to modify, because you know we get stuff in all the time. The way we do it is a customer will say, "Hey, I got this thing. Can you mod it?" We say, "Eh, we haven't seen it yet. Send it in." They'll send it in, and we'll take a while and really come up with the best at what we can do. And if it doesn't really measure up to the kind of baseline that we've had, which fortunately was kind of started with the 002s and 003s, because that's what we really became known for, and those modded are absolutely outstanding. So we already really set the bar kind of high for ourselves. So if anything doesn't have an extreme amount of improvement that we don't have to charge an arm and a leg for, we'll say, okay, yeah, we can do this mod. But if the modification only brings, you know, kind of a mediocre or less than outstanding improvement, we say, nah, we'd just rather recommend a customer take that money and then in that case definitely put it towards a better interface.
What's the best-selling mod that you have, or the most asked-for mod?
That's a good question. The Apollos are really flying. Even after all these years, we're still doing Digis, Digi 002s and 003s. We always have at least a couple in the shop every week. I'd say probably the Apollos, Armies.
I didn't know you did upgrades on the Apollos. What happens there? What's the upgrade?
There's a couple different stages that we do in the mod. We go through the analog path and basically really revamp that. You know, a lot of the components when you know manufacturers develop these things, even in development, they're looking at a price point even before the design is complete. You know, so there's a lot of different components that we're able to swap out. And when our head tech, when he comes up with the mods, I know this is going to sound so backwards, but he'd have to just look, you know, in the catalog or go on the website and see what comparable components that he can put in and find out which one specs higher or which one is more expensive and just swap the parts out. He'll get everything that could possibly be used in that spot, like in that footprint on the circuit board. And he'll get each one and he'll literally solder it in and then listen to it. Then try the next one, solder it, listen to it. And this is why developing the modifications are so time consuming, because it's a very meticulous process. But in a lot of the cases, the better specking component may not be the best sounding one. And that's also in how they work in combination with each other. So so that's one of the things we go through the analog path. And there's some also some tweaks that we do surrounding the converter chip and that conversion circuitry, because most of these interfaces really have really decent converter chips in them. But what hinders their performance is the circuitry that surrounds them. So our guys have figured out ways of going in there, and you know, they do some little tweaks, they do some decoupling and things like that to enable that converter to actually perform closer to its specification. A lot of times you'll see on different forums, you know, guys talk about, you know, I've seen it where they go, hey, man, I got my mod back, and I can't believe you swapped out my pre's and you put a new converter chip in there. And, I mean, that is actually completely not true. For one, a lot of these interfaces, or all these interfaces, it's not like they have individual preamps, you know, connected to the XLR, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's just one large analog board, and the pre's are contained on the board. So what we do in the modification through the analog stage improves those sounds of the pre's. It's not a different preamp. Mm-hmm. And with the converter chip, it's actually the same chip. We don't swap out the chips at all. It's just the tweaks that our guys do around that in that circuitry improves its performance. So it winds up sounding like it would have maybe a different chip, but, yeah, it's sort of a misnomer. Kind of see it here and there when people write us back and say thanks.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's cool. I can see why it makes good sense to actually come out with your own interface then, because you kind of know them inside out if you've been seeing them and modding them.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, and that's one of the things that there's in pretty much every modification. There's things that we would like to do, but there's different hindrances because of certain design, you know, certain, you know, footprints on the circuit boards, you know, things that that we're just not able to do. There's no, you know, there's restrictions there in just the inner design or actually in the physical space in some of the units. You know, a lot of these 1U interfaces, there's just, you know, there's no real estate to be able to do what we do. Like with the digis, those, I think those wound up being so, so stellar is that, just because of the layout on the boards and there's so much room in that box, we're able to do the mod, you know, the clock mod. We're able to put our own clock in there, and we're able to put a second linear power supply because it's a 2U box, and the way things are spaced in there, there's room for it.
Wow.
You know, but unfortunately, a lot of these other, you know, 1U interfaces, you know, there's no room to do that. So when in designing our own, we're able to obviously start from scratch, so we have that freedom to really do what we want to do. And we have absolutely no intent of releasing an interface if it's not going to be, you know, better than our best mod. So
what's the ETA for that?
Well, that kind of depends on money, you know. But we're shooting for within a year. Uh-huh. If all the planets align right, hopefully within the year. But of course, once all the design and everything's taken care of and we're ready to start production, that's when, you know, it depends on how the money is, if we have enough money to get parts and quantities and things like that. So we're trying to put a little bit aside here and there. That's sort of my job, you know, but,
yeah,
of course, like I said, you know, being a small company like ours, you know, with a smaller profit margin, it gets a little tricky in that kind of thing. So, yeah, one of our guys has an aunt that passes away and leaves us, you know, a fortune, then shoot, give it 6 months.
Yeah.
But, we're shooting for, within a year.
Cool. Blackline is unique because you have both analog and digital products, and most companies are good at one or the other, and not both, you know what I mean? So it's really unique, and they're two different animals too. So it's very cool that you can do both and do them both well.
You know what? I agree. We've been really, really fortunate to get the guys that we have. Like I said, every single person here has actually come to us wanting to intern. And we've had a lot of different guys. It's not like everybody that comes to intern we've hired on, believe me. I think it was just right timing. The stuff that we were doing when we were, you know, getting really well known for these Digimods and just hearing what we're able to do with those got a lot of attention of really, really talented guys that came to us saying, hey, you know, this is what I'd like to do. And we've been very fortunate to be able to kind of handpick extremely talented dudes.
Yeah. Well, and you're lucky. I mean, you're in Chicago, so that's kind of in, you know, middle of the country, so and with good schools around, so I'm sure that that helps as well.
Oh yeah. We've seen just recently more of a resurgence in the guys that are wanting to come in to intern. I guess it kind of goes in waves. I'm really not sure why, but you know, and unfortunately, you know, guys will come in and kind of learn the ropes, but that's another thing is that they'll come in, learn the ropes, and they get wound up, you know, a lot of these guys have been schooled, but in actual real world applications, it's a completely different ball game.
Yeah.
You know, and in fact, even to the way we do things, because like I said, you know, when we first started designing things, nobody knew how to design gear. No one was schooled in that. We just sort of learned it the hard way and really, I guess, maybe lucked out into making some extremely fortunate mistakes. When we had our first, the Sparrow ADC, we were deciding to make a Mark II version of it, you know, that was rack mountable. We brought in another engineer, this guy who worked for a very large microphone company, very established, knew his stuff. And we brought him in to kind of help us because at that point it got to, you know, there's some things in the business like, you know, FCC regulations and things like that was way over our heads. So we needed some guy who knew his stuff. And he came in and was looking at how we were designing things going, what in the world are you doing? This is not how you do this. We're going, well, that's how we do it. He's like, this isn't going to work. This is going to sound awful. And then we'd finish it and we'd try it out. He's going, I can't believe how good this sounds.
Wow.
this is kooky. What? How in the world, you know, no one takes all these different components and just tries them out one by one and listens to it. No one does that. And we're like, well, I guess we didn't know that. we've always done. You know, and when he saw how the mods were, you know, we did the mods, he was just kind of, you know, face palming, going, how can you guys do this? You know, how do you stay in business? It's like, well, we just sort of do what we do, and it's, you know, and people like it. You know, I think, you know, there's no question. I mean, like I said, I'm not one of the guys that mods these things, so I can be objective about it and say, God, man, you know, a lot of these modifications are just amazing. You know, I have, you know, everyone here has our own mods, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you know. And the reviews on just about everything have been great across the board. So, you know, I look at some of the reviews from various magazines and they're all stellar.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I don't want to try and shoot some stuff, but, you know, when it comes to, you know, the magazine reviews, they're great. And I don't think that anybody's, you know, full of crap when they're reviewing our stuff, you know, that's really what they think. But I think what really speaks for it is, you know, what customers say. You know, the fact that we had, we went for the first 6-7 years that we were a company, we didn't do any advertising. The only advertising we had was word of mouth. One satisfied customer who's telling somebody else going, hey, I got this thing. You need to check these guys out.
Yeah.
And the fact that we were able to grow as a business, and not just grow, but I mean just sustain ourselves for one, stay afloat, but also grow in that kind of, you know, business model is really bizarre.
Well, that's so, how I found you, though. It was by, you know, word of mouth. It was on the forums, various forums. And I kept on seeing the name coming up all the time with, you know, happy users.
Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, we're fans of our fans. I mean, of our customers. We really are.
Yeah.
And I know it sounds hokey, man, but it's, you know, it's like a musician or an artist that's, you know, really having that identity with their fan base, because, you know, without our customers, we'd be long gone.
Yeah.
You know, but people really support us. They like what we do, and we want to do right by them. And we endeavor to do so. You know, we've got a couple opportunities actually to blow up. You know, really step things up and kind of change things around. And we've chosen not to do it.
Oh, that's cool.
Because we want to stay true to our customer base.
That's excellent. Last question for you, and then I'll let you go because I know you're busy. What's the best piece of business advice that you either learned along the way or that you received from somebody else?
Wow, that's a good one. Well, we've gotten a lot of good advice that we knew was good advice and still didn't take it. you know, several years ago, you know, we've had lots of different guys, kind of household name type of guys, you know, in the industry that have flat out, people I've talked to personally that told me going, you know, with our MicroHawk Mark II, the performance of that thing was just amazing. And we were selling it for, you know, $500-$600. And this guy was going, you guys are idiots if you don't just redesign a case for it so it looks a little nicer. You know, because we design things with the price in point. You know, we want us to be able to sell for, you know, not a lot of money. So when we made that case and, you know, when you looked at it, it's ugly. It's just very unimpressive. It's a little box. It's got a knob, a switch, and three BNC outputs. Nothing fancy, you know. But without all the hoopla and bells and whistles, we were able to keep the price really inexpensive. And he was going, you know, you sold this for, you know, $500-$600. You should be selling this for, you know, maybe $18,000-$2,000.
Mm.
People would still buy it. And he said the only customers that you would lose are the guys that can't afford that thing, but you would gain more customers than you would lose because no one takes your price point seriously. They say a word clock for $600, and they look at it and they go, ah, that can't be anything. You know, that really isn't worth my time to even investigate. They said, if you make it look really slick, raise the price, man, they'll fly. And we went, we don't want to do that. You know, so I think in some of that good advice, it really kept our value straight.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. You know, you can always do a premium model that's basically the same thing in a nicer case. And then you have two of them, you know.
Oh, well, that's sort of what we have now. We actually still are doing the MicroHawk Mark II, but with our MicroHawk Mark III, we definitely souped that up a little bit. We have it's in a rack mountable case now with actually removable rack ears. So because you've got the live guys that love the small compact thing where you can throw it in a backpack or you can just sit on top of your console, you know, that these guys love that. Then you've got other guys in the studio going, God, I wish I could, you know, rack this thing. So we gave it removable rack ears. It's also got a LED display now, so you know, you can just scroll through and select the frequency you want. It's got a lot more different outputs as well than just the three BNCs. So, and there's been a huge improvement to its guts. You know, it's got we did a lot of different redesigning with the actual circuitry, so it's definitely higher performing. And we've thought about putting out an even higher version of that, like like the macro clock or something that's just has all sorts of different connectivity, like video syncing stuff and all these kind of things, and put it in a really slick box and making it absolutely the best that we can do.
yeah.
like sparing no cost. That way, it would be more expensive, but it wouldn't be intended for, you know, the little guy.
Yeah, sure.
You know?
Sure. Well, that's cool. You stay true to your values and your philosophy, and that's to be applauded for sure.
Oh, so, thanks. I mean, we try, you know?
Well, Sid,
you know, it's funny. We, you know, we still do things, as I'm talking to you, I got a, when it comes to like our faceplates, we screen them in-house. We screen print them right here. And that's one of the things that, as I forgot, as you were calling me, that was one of the things I needed to do is get in here and, take care of some of this stuff. So yeah, we don't even farm this stuff. We don't even, you know, farm the graphics out. We, we've got a whole bunch of screens in here and we screen print all that stuff by hand.
Wow.
Is, you know, really kind of grassroots boutique-y, but it's kind of who we've always been. And
yeah,
but,
that's very cool. Sid, thanks for your time. I enjoyed the chat. You can find out more about Black Lion Audio at their website, blacklionaudio1word.com. blacklionaudio1word.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me at questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. I'm really happy to answer any questions, and I really love your comments, so please keep sending them. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. Steve helps put the show together. Many, many thanks to Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can now find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.